Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Hey, Tommy, I'm super jealous because you got to drive one of my dream cars, and that is the new Defender Octa, the Top Dog Octa, and I didn't get to go on that program, so we're going to talk all about that, plus something else.
Yeah, so I got to talk to this guy who actually competed in Camel Trophy, which is the most hardcore off-road adventure maybe that's existed in the last 50 years. So it's a really cool conversation we had about what it was like, you know, competing in the dense jungle against other off-road slash Olympic enthusiasts in this kind of off-road competitions.
Yeah, what they would do is they would take Range Rovers and Land Rovers, probably Land Rovers, it was probably discos back in the day if I remember right, and they would helicopter them into like the most inhospitable places like Borneo and just drop them in, and then the team had to find their way out in places where there were no roads or where there were muddy roads that kind of looked like roads. So I'm super excited to hear all about that. But let's start and talk about the new Octa, which is kind of the Defender that's going to compete with the G-Wagon somewhat.
So basically, you're exactly right, right? Land Rover has this somewhat luxury, somewhat adventurous four-wheel drive called the Defender, which runs between like $60,000 and $120,000, let's say, right? And there's two doors, there's four doors, there's long wheelbases, there's four cylinders, six cylinders, and eight cylinders. But what they realized is people were, you know, cross-shopping these against a huge variety of vehicles, including the G-Wagon. And they said, well, why are we letting Mercedes dominate that like $150,000 to $200,000 price point with their luxury SUV? Let's make a more extreme version of the Defender called the Octa.
Yeah, what they realize is that the middle class is dead. So let's go for the crazy expensive segment of the off-road market. And let's compete with the G-Wagon, which kind of sort of makes sense because they've been selling, you know, the autobiography Range Rover and doing really well with them. That's a $250,000 car when you spec it all out. How much is the new Octa?
The one I drove was about $170,000. So it's kind of right in line with the Mercedes G, right? But what's cool about it is it's not just a Defender with some more leather and a different engine. They actually went ahead and fundamentally re-engineered a lot of the car, specifically the suspension, and they've done some pretty amazing things with it.
Well, let's start with the most important part. Did they give it more horsepower?
Yeah, they did. They actually gave it an entirely different engine.
Oh, that is important.
So you've got the four-cylinder 2-liter, the 3-liter inline six, and then the 5-liter supercharged V8.
In the regular Defender.
In the normal Defender. This has a 4.4-liter twin-turbo V8 from BMW.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like a German engine.
Yeah, so
4.4.
626 horsepower, 0 to 60 according to Land Rover in 3.8 seconds.
And they've used that engine in a lot of other JLR cars. So it's in the F-Type, for instance. I drove that with that same 4.4. It's a really good engine, actually. Germans build pretty incredible V8s. Who would have thunk?
Well, and I think more famously, too, related to this, it's in the full-size Range Rover, yeah. Right? So you can now get that BMW engine in the new Range Rover. But yeah, it's a very impressive performance machine because you get this huge range of midline torque that just shoves it down the road so fast. It's unbelievable what this thing can do. My only problem with it is it's very toned down. So the exhaust note is very subdued. Now, there is a loud mode, right? You can open up the baffle and make it a little bit louder, but it still is a little too quiet for my liking.
It feels more like a Raptor competitor. And what I mean by that is like a Baja runner than a true rock crawler.
Well, and I asked them about that. Like, what are they targeting? And they wouldn't definitively say that this is a high-speed one or this is a rock crawl one. They said that this is, like, the ultimate expression of luxury off-road capability. So Octa is in reference to a diamond, right? The 8 points on a diamond. And that's kind of what they're going for. Like, it's supposed to be really tough. It's supposed to be very kind of special and unique and luxurious and is able to conquer a lot of things.
Do you have any numbers behind that? Like, what's the 0 to 60?
Yeah, so 3.8 seconds, 0 to 60. The most impressive thing about this, though, is not the 0 to 60 for me. It's actually the suspension design. So this vehicle sits several inches wider than the standard Defender. And the reason for that is because they fundamentally re-engineered the suspension. So, you know, like on a standard Defender, you have air suspension, right?
Yeah.
And the way it works is you have air struts with essentially a shock absorber built into that air strut, right? And then you have sway bars, front and rear, to keep everything in under control. The Octa gets rid of the sway bars altogether. And instead of having an air strut with a standard shock absorber within it, it's an air strut with a hydraulic damper inside the air strut. And what that means is they can get rid of the sway bars and control the body roll and the suspension articulation using hydraulics instead of a solid metal beam. So amazing what it can do. And there's a new mode called Octa mode. And what the Octa mode is...
That's what? Funny, Octa mode.
So you push and hold the button.
Every time you say it, I think of Octopussy out of James Bond.
Oh, gosh.
I do. I'm sorry. My brain just goes right there.
Problematic.
It's not a problem. It's my youth. I grew up watching James Bond movies, and this was, you know, a classic movie. And so there is that... association. I don't think that is problematic. And one day in your life, you're going to have that association. If you have kids, they're going to look at you and be like, oh my God, Dad.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe you're right. But if you push and hold the Octa button on the steering wheel, the paddle shifters glow red, which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
And then it loosens up the suspension. So then you can get that kind of desert running nice. Raptor feel. And it really does feel like a Raptor. It's got this great float to it. So we did some high-speed stuff. We did some rock crawl stuff as well. It's got 20-inch wheels, which are too big, but it does have a massive Goodyear Wrangler RT tire, so an actual beefy off-road tire. And what that means is that we were able to take it up some pretty cool stuff, especially with the rear and center locking diff. It's pretty good.
So I think here's a problem, and maybe not a problem, but here's kind of the issue I would have with this if it were me looking at this car. So obviously, I just said that this kind of competes or plays in the G-Wagon space, right? Where this car is probably never going to go off-road, at least not for the next 7 years. So it's going to be bought by people who are going to use it as their family hauler and who want like the ultimate cool Defender and you know who don't want the four-cylinder one that we had because that's for the plebs.
Sure.
They want to show off that they've got the big boy. But if I'm looking at this in a purely practical manner, right? If I was looking for an off-road vehicle that does what this does, I would look at the other Raptor, and that's the Bronco Raptor, because it's very similar, right? So you've got kind of a wider stance. You've got more off-road capability. And Ford just dropped the price of that $10,000.
So it's about half half the money.
It's about a half. It's about $80,000 now. And I kind of feel like if I'm just looking for the ultimate, you know, four-seater off-roader SUV, that might be a better choice because I wouldn't feel bad about getting it dirty and getting it scraped up and getting
sure.
it. You know what I mean?
Well,
so you got this vehicle that does the same thing that a vehicle for half the price does.
But two words for you.
What's that?
Or two letters, V8.
Yeah, that's true.
You got the 600. Raptor Bronco, right? Amazing off-road vehicle. Probably more capable than this, but twin-turbo V6.
Well, probably is more. It's on 35s.
This has got 200 more horsepower, though, right? It's got this thundering kind of V8 under the hood.
Yeah, but you don't need 200 more when you're off-roading.
No, but if you're going to... Listen, it is nice to kind of hear, and I know I said it's not loud enough, but it is a very cool thing to kind of hear this low lump.
So is a V8 worth $80,000?
Well, that's probably not.
That's the calculation I'd be doing.
Yeah. But like, to their credit, I do think that this is a more capable machine. It's got increased underbody protection compared to the standard one. It's got more suspension travel. It's got actually different control arms and different suspension hardware. So they actually changed the meat of the vehicle as well, which I think is very cool.
Yeah, it doesn't have fender flares that look like they were, you know, tacked on.
So it does have fender flares.
But not like the Bronco Raptor where it looks like they just kind of had an afterthought. Oh, God, we got to get bigger fender flares for government regulations.
I mean, to your point, I think it's a little too subtle. So if I, like going down the road, unless you really knew what you were looking for, which is like the slight flare, the slightly different exhaust, the recovery point in orange, it's tough to distinguish this from a normal Defender. So I wish they had gone a little more bold with its styling.
And you know, Jeep does, at least they used to build a Wrangler with a V8, which is also cheaper than this.
Yeah.
I'm just playing devil's advocate here. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this. I'm just saying there are cheaper alternatives. And to me, it is a little too subtle with the Bronco Raptor being a little too unsubtle. You know, I mean, that one is just like, come on, guys.
But once again, like at this point, right, even so that V8 that had with the Wrangler was 470 horsepower, I think?
I think so, yeah. Around 450-ish. Yeah.
This is 150 more.
Yeah.
Right? So more horsepower. You also get a much nicer interior. Yeah. So both.
Oh, you're right, 470.
Yeah, both the Jeep and the Ford of a pretty cut-rate interior. This thing is leather over everything, and it's got these one-piece, like, performance bucket seats that have the speakers built into the backrest, so the whole seat thumps.
And, of course, it's a convertible.
It's not a convertible. Listen, I'm not saying this is good value. I think it's too expensive probably for what it is, but it is a very impressive piece of technology with that suspension.
Yeah, and I think you're right. If you're going after the G really has had no true off-road competition in mm-hmm. its space forever. But the problem with going after the G is it's not about the off-roadness of the vehicle. It's about the fact that, you know, it because of popular culture and because of who buys it, it's become kind of this status symbol that transcends. There are a few vehicles that transcend the brand. And so a G-Wagon could be its own brand.
Sure.
Just like
Defender.
Just like a 911 could be its own brand.
I think Defender could be its own brand. I think Bronco could be its own brand. I think Wrangler could be its own brand.
No, I think I'm going to be a little bit tighter on that, on those rules. I think a 911 could be its own brand. Or actually, a GT3 could be its own brand as opposed to just a 911. And I think a Corvette could be its own brand. I'm not sure a Defender could be its own brand. I think it kind of lost it when they stopped selling them here for how many years?
Three.
It was longer than that, wasn't it?
Three or four, yeah. It was like 94 through 97. So it's not like they had...
No, they didn't import the old Defenders. They only imported them... No, they stopped selling Defenders here a lot longer than that.
Well, the ones that you're... The North American spec Defenders...
Were only here for like 4 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you have to be in constant production like Corvette
yeah,
or like 911 for like 30, 40 years and like G-Wagon before you can be an iconic, you know, sub-brand.
I disagree, though, because G-Wagon didn't come to the U.S. until 2001. So you had 30 years of G-Wagon that people knew what they were.
Yeah,
they just
weren't Defender imported. Didn't come to the U.S. until the mid-90s and it only came here for 4 years.
Yeah, but people know what a Defender... I think a Defender in some ways is a... Because of the long history of Defender, you know, arguably dating back to the
40s. Can we make a rule that you have to be in continuous production for like and available to buy mm-hmm. for like, let's say, 30 years, like 911, like Corvette?
Well, that's Defender. Defender has been...
No, in America.
Oh, but you're being too small-minded, right? I don't think that just because it's America that it matters.
It does matter because if the car's not here, it doesn't become iconic. Yeah, sure. People gray market and people knew about them, but unless you can walk into a dealer and buy one, it's not actually an iconic vehicle.
I don't know. The GTR was iconic.
Another one, Mustang. Mustang would transcend Ford.
I think GTR was iconic even when it wasn't sold here.
Yeah, it wasn't the same.
Because people knew what it was.
All right. Anyway, we don't want to bicker about that. We'll let that be. So you like that?
Would
you spend your $160,000 on this or a G-Wagon? Let me ask you. Okay, you got four cars here.
Uh-huh.
Okay, your money. I'm giving you $160,000.
Mm-hmm.
You can have an Octa, you can have a G, you can have a Bronco Raptor, or you can have a V8 Wrangler.
Do I get to keep the rest of the money?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I think that it would make sense to go Bronco and then keep the rest of the money, but this doesn't compete with the Bronco or the Jeep. It's a totally different class, right? In an off-road mind, you are thinking like an off-roader. But people that are buying this, like you said, they're not cross-shopping it with off-roaders.
Well, I got news for you. I think a lot of people who are buying Bronco Raptors aren't, you know, taking them off-road. I think they're buying them because the same reason they're going to buy this, because it's the biggest, baddest Bronco they can get their hands
but
on.
But I would argue that this is bigger and badder than the Bronco because it's got a V8.
Sure.
So, I mean, I think that if you compared this against the Range Rover, the G-Wagon, and then the Octa, I would take this over both of those.
You take that over a G?
For sure.
Okay, why?
Because it's got a V8. I can't explain
but
to you.
But she has a V8.
No,
you,
it does
you
not.
You can get a G
the
with
G63,
a
but the normal G...
It's $175 for a G63. That's what they start with. It's like $12,000 more than this.
But you're not going to touch a G63 for under $200. You're just not. And I think that this is arguably a more capable vehicle out of the box.
Look, if you want a German V8, buy the German car. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I hear your point. But this is going to go much farther than a G-Wagon's going to go out of the box.
Why?
Because it actually has real tires and actual suspension.
They also make an off-road version of the G-Wagon.
Not to this extent, though.
They make that. There's that, like that new off-road.
I mean, the trail I did in this, you wouldn't want to do in a stock G. I mean, look at the tires they put on them. This is an actual Goodyear Wrangler. This is basically a mud terrain, right?
Okay.
This is more aggressive.
But there is a G where you can get...
Yes, but it's like we had it, right?
Yeah.
This would go a lot farther than that G.
Okay, all right.
It's wider. It's got more clearance.
Well, if Mercedes, you're listening and... JLR, you're listening. Tommy just threw out the ultimate a challenge. Please set up a loan with our man Zach, and we will see which one goes further, and we can settle that once and for all. And we can also, Ford, if you're listening, you can also throw a Bronco Raptor in there just for fun.
The problem with the G-Wagon, it's an incredible vehicle, but you have to do things to it out of the box. Like, you got to get rid of the steps. And then you've got the exhausts that are hanging in the wrong spot. And then you've got the street tires you got to change. Even the off-road ones are not off-road worthy enough. So, like, it's an amazing platform, but they don't give you the stuff from ground one.
And that's interesting. Maybe there's a lesson there for Land Rover. And that is, you know, the reason that they don't give you that is most people don't want that.
Sure.
Most
people
are buying these to go on-road and not off-road.
And I think most of these are going to be sold with the street tires.
Okay.
Yeah. That even they were like, people are going to buy them with the street tires and the 22s. So,
does it come in a two-door or just four-door?
Only four-door.
Okay, I figured.
Yeah. All right, everybody. So we're going to now cut to my interview with my...
Did you explain what the Camel Trophy is?
Yep, right at the beginning of the interview. And you'll learn all about it and learn about why it's one of the most infamous off-road
adventures. Well, I'm looking forward to listening to this.
All right, everybody. So we've got a really special guest. And I've been wanting to talk to the gentleman next to me for a long time. And my first introduction to Jim here was actually winching a Land Rover up a hill backwards at Land Rover Trek. I'm like, oh, I get to meet one of the Camel Trophy guys. And then he spent the whole time yelling at me to winch faster, which I was not expecting. But Jim, can I have you introduce yourself?
Sorry, but that was my job.
It was your job, man, for sure.
I'm Jim Sweat. I've been with Land Rover now since 1995. I competed in Camel Trophy in 1995 on the first American co-ed team. So I was with Daphne Green. And our Camel Trophy was in Central America. We started and ended in Belize. And then we went to Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and back into Belize.
Now, this is a big deal for me, folks, because when I was a kid, what got me into the world of off-roading was watching the YouTube documentary of Camel, right? And seeing what you guys were up to, these adventures through the most remote parts of the world, right? And then I was like, maybe one day I can cosplay something like that, and that's kind of what I do now, Jim. But kind of like, for someone that's never heard of Camel Trophy, just explain what it is.
So, Camel Trophy was started in 1980, and there was basically, I think, a half a dozen German teams.
Okay.
They were actually in Jeeps the first year. Most of the vehicles didn't make it through the first Camel Trophy, so that's why Land Rover got involved. They became a vehicle sponsor, and they were the vehicle sponsor from 1981 until 2000. Camel Trophy is not a race or a rally. It's an off-road adventure that a number of different countries, because I say a number because they varied in quantity in years, but my year it was 20 different countries, and you got picked by a selection process. We can go into that a little bit if you want, but
yeah.
So basically though, Camel Trophy was if you got picked for Camel Trophy, you went to the host country that you were going to start in, and you had about 48 hours of special tasks, and those are mostly physical, vehicle-related, recovery-related. Could be swimming, could be mountain biking, could be running. Anything you can orienteer on, they have you do that. Orienteering in a canoe, orienteering on a mountain bike, orienteering on foot, orienteering in a car. We did all of it. There was GPS back then, but there certainly wasn't all the technology that we have now.
And what's cool about it, too, is, as Jim kind of mentioned, is you competed against participants from different countries from all around the world, right?
Correct.
So, you like, for example, you were on, I assume, Team U.S., is that correct?
Correct, yep.
Were there multiple teams from the U.S., or were you guys the only ones representing the U.S.?
Every year, each country, again, after that first one that was all Germany-based, every year after that, only one team per country. The team consists of two competitors in the front seat of whatever vehicle, Land Rover, they were using that year.
Yeah.
My year happened to be a four-door Discovery 300 TDI, and then there's also two journalists in the back seat with you. I had Eric Schlegel as a photojournalist and Sue Mead as the journalist as well in the back seat, and which makes it for relatively tight quarters in a Discovery,
Discovery one.
With four people basically geared up for a three-week adventure.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
And again, the 1,000 or 1,200 mile, they base it off about a 1,000-mile route. And in that 1,000 miles, ours happened to be a little longer that year. But in that route, you're not competing against them except during tasks. what you're doing in the convoy is actually working together as a group of 20 plus all the support vehicles to get you through that route, whether you needed to build bridges, do recoveries, bushwhack trails, fix your vehicle if you broke it, write up any vehicle that might have been tipped over, you know, all that kind of good stuff.
Yeah. And like, what I want to make very clear is, you know, in this job, I get to drive some cool stuff off-road, right? And I go on these press trips, and they're very manicured, right? We're in these beautiful Land Rovers in beautiful hotels, and if I were to get a flat tire, the team would fix it, and then they would stick me in another one. This was not that, right, Jim? So you were out there in these discoveries in the most remote part of the world relying on yourselves. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the way the American team worked, because, I mean, let's be frank, we have a bit of a reputation as being cocky Americans.
Sure.
So our team trainers, Tom Collins and the whole group that trained us, they really make sure that you're going to be very self-sufficient. Not that you wouldn't ask for help from other teams if you needed it, but you wouldn't want to ask them to do something for you that you should be able to do.
Now, is this scored, Jim? Like, was there a winner at the end of the competition?
There is. It is scored, but again, so the special task, so you've got about 2 days worth of steady special tasks. That means 48 hours straight, no sleep, limited food. So 48 hours of special tasks before you start your convoy. And then along the way, they sprinkle a few extras in along the way. And that's the only time that you're competing against the other countries.
Right.
And then at the end of it, they need a couple more days of special tasks so that they can figure out all of the scoring and all of the rest of the stuff while you're out there busting your butt.
Yeah.
So those tasks are actually empirically scored, right? So there's actual scores with those. Mm-hmm. Now here, about the tasks also, it could be any divisible number of 20. So you could be cutthroat, one against 19 other teams, each competing separately. Or you could be teams of two countries, which means there'd be 10 two-country teams competing against each other, depending how much stuff you needed at that task.
Right.
It could be four teams of five, could be five teams of four, could be two teams of 10. And that's the limit of the division.
So, Jim, you said you've done this twice. Is that correct?
I did. I was invited back in Mongolia in 97 as a support driver. You can only compete once.
Yeah.
And then if they like you and they think you can work well with others, which is all part of it anyways, if you're lucky, you can be invited back and you can be in a support vehicle, in a support role. I actually drove the ambulance with a doctor and a dentist in it in Mongolia, chasing around all the teams and making sure everybody's healthy.
So let's start with your competition. So what year did you compete in Camel?
1995. Central America was called Mundo Maya.
So kind of walk me through the mileage that you guys drove and where you were at in Central America.
So we started in, I want to say, Lamanai, which is a old Mayan pyramid site that's been somewhat reclaimed and somewhat fixed up so it kind of looks a little more like what it was when it was being used. And then Lamanai, I'm going to pronounce it wrong.
It's okay.
Zanutinich was the other point. And I might have them confused start and finish, but those were the two start and finishes. I'm just a little gray.
No, it's been a long 30 time
years.
Ago.
Yeah.
And how long was that total time you were down in Central America?
So we were there for about 25, 26 days. The actual competition was about 21 days. But they give you a day or two to acclimate to the host country. And then at the end, they actually, you know, you got to have a party at the end. So.
So they drop you off at this Mayan temple. That's where you start, right?
Correct.
In a bright yellow Discovery.
Yeah, well, that's where we saw our Discovery for the first time, right?
Yeah. So did you have any idea of what you were getting into? Or was it like immediately you were doing some crazy stuff, or was there kind of a buildup?
No buildup. It was right in.
Okay.
But it was a mass start for the, you know, looks good for the pictures.
Looks
and everything
good for
like
the
that.
Pictures, yeah.
Yeah, it's good marketing. So again, you got there, you got about a day in a real hotel, and then you were kind of brought out to the site as the group. But there was lots of journalists, even lots more journalists than was even going to be in the vehicles with us, because at the start and the finish, they
brought in more people.
They ramp a lot of people up there. But they throw you right under the bus, like I say, 48 hours straight. the rainy season, they usually work it during the rainy season so that you get a lot of mud and
we don't want to make it too easy on you, Jim.
Right. Well, it just so happened my year, the rainy season didn't show up until like the day we were going home.
Okay.
But it was crazy hot and humid. So it was about the temperature that I heard all the time being said was, it was about 117 in the shade.
Wow.
With about 98% humidity. So it would really sap you pretty hard that first day or two. That's what Camel Trophy is all about too. They want to see what you react like once you're sleep deprived, you know, not food starved, but certainly not the best food that you're going to have back home.
Yeah.
So, and then of course you got to deal with all the people and you got to deal with your dynamic in the car as well.
So walk me through that start of that competition. Like, what were some of the things that you were doing?
So I want to say one of the first ones was, had to do with some semaphore. Do you know what semaphore is?
No, can you explain
that? Have you ever seen the Navy guys signals?
Yeah.
And you can actually communicate with people with the flag signals?
Uh-huh.
So that was another skill set that you had to learn before you got there.
Okay.
Otherwise, you couldn't really communicate well on a couple of the tasks. There wasn't only a couple of tasks that actually had that part of it in it. But again, that was one of the things. They give you kind of a whole host of stuff that you better study up on if you haven't been privy to any of that before. Obviously, navigating, orienteering with a compass and map, orienteering with a GPS, all kinds of recovery skill sets you need to do with vehicle recovery. Rope skills, because you're going to probably be on some ropes doing some crazy stuff in tasks, because not all the tasks were vehicle related.
Okay.
Back to the scoring a little bit. So they scored you on the special task part of it, but then the convoy, which was the big part of your time, you know, about 20, 21 days, towards the end of the convoy, they gave each vehicle a list, and you would rank who you thought of the 20 countries had the best team spirit.
Okay.
So it was all about special tasks and team spirit. The combined scores of those two won you Camel Trophy. So you could win special tasks, and you could win team spirit, but you didn't have to win either of those and still be the top one, because say you were second place in each of them and the other one wasn't first place in both of them, then you would have won. Now, so we did not win. I think we were tied for fourth.
Pretty good.
Which is pretty good, yep.
Pretty darn good. Now, Jim, let's talk about some of your experiences. So you're driving these discoveries, and like, were you driving over paved roads? Was it dirt roads? Were you in the jungle? Like, what was the terrain like?
I don't believe that we had more than a couple of miles of pavement.
In 21 days?
There's not a lot of pavement in Guatemala and Belize. Well, towards the cities there are, but we didn't go through most of the cities. If we went through a town, it was usually, you know, the people would come out and they would look at you like you were an alien.
Yeah, right.
Because you're coming through with a whole bunch of sand glow painted yellow vehicles, you know, with stickers all over them. But again, the other thing too is we're all about goodwill. Also, every year during Camel Trophy, they would always have a humanitarian side of it. So like our year, when we got up to the Belize, Mexico, Guatemala border, there was a actual, what do you call it when they're digging stuff out of the ground?
Mine?
Huh?
Like a mine?
No. For fossils and...
Oh, like archaeology.
Archaeology, thank you. So they were doing an archaeology dig at one of the Mayan sites that hadn't been reclaimed yet.
Oh, cool.
or cleared off yet.
Yeah.
And so we spent a couple of days hiking into the mountains and doing a lot of legwork for those guys, physical work. And then we also donated a building to the
awesome.
Outpost where they were doing a lot of the archaeology digs and stuff. So, and then we continued our journey, which we spent the most amount of time in Guatemala. That's the bigger country in Central America.
So how many miles or kilometers do you think you drove total?
We did about 1,200 miles. If you're going to ask me to go click that at the kilometers,
okay.
It's about 1,700 or so.
It's a distance.
It's a distance.
And it sounds like you're not cruising that 70. Like, you're doing some pretty hard stuff.
Majority was in low range, but there were places when you're on dirt roads, kind of like we were on today,
yeah,
that you could get into high box and you know, cruise around 50, 60 miles an hour.
So what are some of your favorite vehicle-related memories from that competition?
Oh, vehicle-related memories. Let's see. One of my favorite pieces of it, so I'm an off-road guy and have been forever. Daphne wasn't as skilled in the off-road side of things, but
who's
she was
your partner,
Daphne,
right?
Green. Yep. Yeah. She was a physical phenom, though. She could outrun me. She could outswim me. I'm not a huge endurance guy.
Fair enough.
I had the most endurance in my life at 30 because I trained to get ready for it. But so we had a competition where it was a big circle about maybe, I don't know, maybe it was 200 yards, 200 meters or so in diameter. Mm-hmm. So it was a big circle. And then there was a cross in the middle of it that you could, those are four pieces of available, drivable stretch too.
Okay.
But the inside four pieces of the cross had no score. They were just access ways to get you to other legs. But each of the four quarters of the circle had a score related to it. Hmm. And you tried to score as many points driving around the outside of the circle. You had to go through the center, at least. You had to go through all four pieces of the cross before you were allowed to get more score on the outside other than the first round of score.
Okay.
If that makes sense to you.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And
how did you score the points? Just by driving there, or did you have like...
Yes, you had to drive over. Now, you couldn't stop, and you couldn't back up, or you had points deducted.
Okay. So this is like a fine vehicle placement kind of task.
It basically rock crawling. As quickly as you can go, safely, because you don't want to damage your vehicle. You got to drive it quite a while after that.
Yeah.
And this was in the first leg of tasks, I think. It gets a little fuzzy again.
30 years ago, Jim.
So, anyways, the... we stay that left.
Yeah.
And so there was a certain amount of score. So you had 7 minutes for each person driving, each of the two team members.
Yeah.
And I let her drive first because I knew that it was going to be more guiding. And oh, the other part of the rules... So again, you couldn't get if there was 5 points on one quarter, 10 points on another, 12 points on another, whatever the score. They were all different scores because of the difficulty of each of the quarter pieces of the circle.
Yeah.
And again, you couldn't get extra score. You couldn't score one piece twice, so you couldn't do just one triangle like and keep doing that until you hit all four pieces in the middle. Then you could.
Yeah.
Then you could just keep running the high point value one, which was awesome, right? So 7 minutes. Daphne and I'm a loud person. You probably figured that out already. And I'm very communicative. And I have a bit of a vulgar mouth sometimes, especially, you know, when things aren't progressing as exactly how I would like to be.
Sure.
So it was quite interesting because 7 minutes you have to stay in front of the vehicle too. You cannot overdrive your ground spotter.
Okay.
And the ground spotter had to be out all the time, obviously.
And you couldn't stop.
Well, if you stopped, you got point deduction. Okay. And if you backed up, you got more point deduction. So the fun part about it was that she was working really well, but she doesn't read. Her forte wasn't in rock crawling.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a specific
I'm not
sale.
Trying to say anything bad about Daphne. I love her to death, and she knows it, and we get along. We're very close friends.
Nice.
So interestingly, I'm loud so that she can hear me, and she happened to get stuck on a rock. We had to back up a little bit. There was some language coming out. So all the journalists that were there videoing us, they all think that we're kind of at each other's throats because it sounds like I'm being mad at her.
Yeah.
In reality, that's just how I talk.
Right.
I get accused of being kind of harsh all the time. So anyways, and then when she got her 7 minutes done, and again, so the next person can't, again, do the whole score until you do the legs again in the middle.
Yeah.
So she got out of the vehicle. I got in the driver's seat, and she says, "What do you want me to do?" Because she knows that this is my forte.
Yeah.
Right. And I said, "Run, run as fast as you can. I will be right behind you. Do you need spotting?" I said, "Run. Don't turn around and even look. Just let's get the four pieces. Let's get the corners." And then we'll just lap that hard spot.
Yeah.
And we won that task.
So you were driving the beans off this discovery.
I was driving the beans off. So, of course, immediately when we get off of that, all the journalists come up and they're like, "So you two are at each other's throats already. You're not getting along." And we're like, "What are you talking about? That's just how we communicate with each other.
Interesting.
mean, we were like, you know, as my real wife calls me, she says, oh, you're going to spend some more time with your road wife.
That's funny.
Yes, it is. So, and they get along great now too. So
when you were kind of going through, like, I would assume there was a lot of dense forests, right?
There was.
Were there times on this journey where you were making or clearing path?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Let me
qualify that. You start the convoy in alphabetical order.
Okay.
Well, USA is always at the end.
Pretty far at the back. Yeah.
So in order to get up and do clearing right up at the front, I'd have to get right up there and go through. Oh, there was 35 vehicles on our convoy because right. There was 20 country teams, and then there's 15 support vehicles.
Yeah. Now, were you guys like, were there ever moments where you were just totally stuck and you had to come up with ways to dig yourselves out and...
No, remember I said rainy season didn't show up. The off-roading on the convoy was much easier than I would have preferred.
Okay,
there were some hard pieces, but they were very, and there was only handfuls of mud. I think I used the winch twice in the convoy. Usually, you're winching a lot. I could say I kind of feel a little gypped on that part of it
because of the dryness.
But that's okay. There was plenty of the heat made up for the dry.
So it sounds like you had more fun in the actual competition side of like the challenges you had to compete.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And were you guys like, were there ever challenges where you were building bridges or building things to traverse over?
Yes. There's always bridges to build. There's always roads to cut. Here's the thing. They pre-scout it a year or two ahead of time.
Yeah.
But they don't always pre-scout the whole route. They may pre-scout pieces, and when it gets to a spot where they don't want to break trail,
yeah,
but they know the trail goes to the next piece that's decent,
yeah,
they just go around it and they leave that for the competition to get through. And if there's a bridge or two out, you got to do that. So there was a couple of bridges out. There was a bunch of stuff where we had to pick and shovel to get, you know, where the whole road had landslid in, stuff like that. So
you're out in the, you're really remote.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You're way off the beaten path.
Yeah.
Did you guys have any like big mechanical trouble that you had to deal with on the trek?
No, we actually were really good with vehicle stuff. So again, I know how to drive a vehicle pretty close to its limit.
Sure.
But not get so far in that I'm usually going to break stuff.
Yeah, sure. It's a good skill to have.
It is a very good skill to have. You know, I think I don't even remember if we changed brake pads towards the end, because usually you're in enough mud and silt and stuff and water and so that you might get some brake wear, but I don't even think we ended up doing a brake pad change, because the back of the vehicle always has, every vehicle that's a competitor vehicle has a spare parts box in the back as well.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
So you have always a spare alternator, you have a couple of, you have spare shocks, spare brakes, spare air cleaner, spare fuel filter,
everything.
Yeah, belts, of course. Yeah, a bunch of stuff. Yeah.
So your takeaways, Jim, like what was the hardest part you had to overcome on Trophy?
Let's see. I mean, so Daphne rolled her ankle real bad towards the end, the last special set of special tasks, and they actually pulled her.
Oh.
So they wouldn't let her compete at the end. And using a journalist was definitely more trying, because even though my male journalist looked like a stud, but his cardio wasn't up to snuff. So we did one canoe event, which is basically a canoe race down a river, back up a river, catch a couple of waypoints, and then you have to run about a mile with your canoe to get to the finish line. And literally the last like 100 yards, he was completely dead. I mean, he looked in better shape than me by far, more studly.
He was done.
And I was dragging him, hanging onto the back of the canoe over the finish line. But if you didn't need your journalists, then they made you compete alone.
So, Jim, I want to list off some activities.
Sure.
And I'm going to ask if you did it in the 21 days. So, canoeing, yes.
Absolutely.
Running.
Yes, lots of it.
Climbing.
Not as much as some years, but yes, some rope. So, we did a lot of ropes.
Okay.
Stuff, you know, where you're... The special tasks can be anything, and it don't have to be vehicle related. So yes.
So you were using ropes.
Yes.
Did you do any biking?
No, mountain biking came the next year.
Okay.
I said it because in the history of Camel, there was that. But ours was a lot of canoeing, a lot of swimming, a lot of running.
Now, and let's make this clear, because Jim's being a little humble here. Swimming, I don't assume, is in a pool.
No. No. Matter of fact, the first thing they did is warned you about whatever that little parasite thing is that can swim up your urethra.
Yes, yes, I've heard about that.
In Central America,
they
that
were
exists.
Telling you about
yes.
that.
Yes.
So you were like
in... And then they told you to get in the water, okay?
So they told you about this very painful parasite.
Correct.
And then they said, all right, now into the river.
Correct. Or the lake, or the lagoon.
What were you swimming for? What was the goal of
so,
swimming?
So, again, that first task that you asked me about, yeah. it was a mass start, and I might be...
remembering it wrong?
I might be confusing and combining a couple of tasks.
Okay. But 30 years ago, people.
I remember that there was a big, giant lagoon.
Okay.
You raced to go get your canoe. Okay. It was 20 separate teams at that point. So it's a Mad Max start for the race. You get your canoe and you send, actually there was two canoes because your partner went across the lagoon. It was one canoe. We went across the lagoon together. You drop one person off at the other side of the lagoon. They orienteer to find the spot that they're supposed to be standing in. They compass back to where you are, to across the lagoon, and they triangulate me in the canoe to get to a spot in the lagoon and then figure out, dive down about 12 feet, and there'll be a fake alligator suspended about 12 feet below the surface of the water.
What the heck?
And you had to find that and then get back to your person, get back to the finish, and that was the task.
That's crazy.
It was nuts because you have no idea if you're in the right spot until you start diving down because the water wasn't clear enough to see the damn thing.
So you're in Central America in like this kind of swamp, it sounds like.
No, it was a big, looked like a lake.
It was a lagoon. Okay, lake. Diving for a fake alligator.
Correct.
Okay.
That was suspended below water about 10, 12 feet, whatever.
That's crazy.
It was awesome.
So was the physicality the hardest part, you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, mental... I mean, this sounds probably a little full of myself.
Sure, go for it.
It seemed like once I got picked for Campbell Trophy, and actually even in the U.S. selections, it really felt like my life had led up to this.
Okay.
I grew up dairy farming, which means you do a variety of everything, plumbing, electrical,
whatever needs to
tractor,
be done.
You fix all kinds of stuff. So I had a good mechanical background. I have a pretty good... in shape background.
Yeah.
My biggest lacking of skill is I'm not a great swimmer.
Okay.
I originally put on my application, it said, how good are you for swimming?
Yeah.
And I put down, I can swim to save my life. My wife made me change that before I sent the app in and says, you're an excellent swimmer.
You're an excellent swimmer, Jim.
That's the only thing, because... Here's the thing. In the selection process, you fill out that application and you tailor your resume to this, obviously. And I was extremely honest on my application and my resume. Not all people are honest.
Okay.
So there were 12 people that went to the U.S. selections my year. There was 2,500 people that applied for the two-person team.
Uh-huh.
Sounds like a lot, but Germany had about... 40,000 to 60,000 people for their two spots.
Jeez.
So there's multiple selection processes before they get to the international selections.
Yeah.
But definitely, when I happened to get to the airport in Denver, waiting for the Grand Junction hop, because that's where we did our U.S. selections, is in Grand Junction.
Oh, cool.
Just so happens.
Just right where we're at.
We're at. And one of the journalists, and I actually happened to be Sue Mead. Do you know Sue?
I do know Sue, yeah.
So she was my journalist in the back seat.
Okay.
And Sue Mead probably broke the rules and let me see the 12 applicants' resumes and applications.
Okay.
Which I'm not sure she's supposed to do that.
But she did.
And at that point, when I read a few of them, I thought, I am not qualified to be here.
Okay, interesting.
That's how much people... will exaggerate about themselves.
To get to that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the problem is you got to be able to do it once you get to the U.S. selections.
You got to prove it.
You got to prove it. And there was four of them probably that came up short really quickly. One of them was a fiction writer in Hollywood.
Mm.
I know his name, but I'm not going to say
sure.
it.
Sure. Yeah.
Because he probably still is alive, and I don't need him coming after me because of whatever. Anyways, he wrote a fiction and handed it and got in like that.
Probably good at.
They asked him to leave before the selection process was over.
Okay.
And they brought him back to the hotel because he had annoyed so many of the judges.
So it sounds like the selection process, like in my mind when I think Camel, I always associate it with the Land Rover brand, right?
Sure.
And the coverage you see is very vehicle driven.
Yep.
But it sounds like in reality, it was a big physical challenge. In some ways, was it more so than a vehicle challenge, would you say?
I mean, for me, yeah, because I was very vehicle-oriented.
Okay, yeah.
Right? I'd already built a bunch of vehicles by then, so I had already, you know, completely restored vehicles. And then I'd been, you know, you're never supposed to go out four-wheeling alone or at night. Well, most of my formidable experience is alone and at night, because when you're young and you have a job,
the only time where else are you going to do it?
At night, and most of my friends were big enough babies, they didn't want to go out at night and wheel with me. So
when you went back and ran support for Mongolia, how did that compare to Central America? I know you weren't competing, but was like the terrain really different? Was the challenges really different?
Yeah, completely different, everything. And the nicest part for me is that I didn't have to be in that good a shape anymore. I had to be in good shape, but I didn't have to be cardioed up, you know?
Right. Got some cows here.
Lots of cows and horses.
So those challenges, were they similar in that they were very like physically exerting?
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of physical. So here's the other thing too. When I say swimming, you're not usually in swimming shorts.
Okay.
You're usually in full gear.
Yeah.
Which is, have you ever swimming clothes?
Freaking hard.
It is
hard.
Yeah. It is not a good, easy thing like you'd think.
Should never be shoes involved with swimming.
There should not be shoes involved with swimming, right?
Yeah.
And of course, they taught you how to take your pants off when you're in the water, scoop up a bunch of air, tie the pant legs together, and pretty much make a flotation device out of your pants if you wanted to.
Right.
Because the pants were all, you know, khaki kind of stuff, so they held air for quite a while. Especially, I don't know how they did, but they did. So
now, Jim, one of the things that would be like a question of mine is, you know, like some of these places you were at are in very remote parts of the world, and in parts of the world, in some cases, that have had like global conflicts and civil wars, and like I would imagine there'd be stuff like minefields.
Right.
Did you ever come across anything like that in
Germany? No. We came in Central America at some border crossings.
Yeah.
It was good to be in a group that big.
Okay.
Because the local border crossing officials.
Yeah.
Tend to like to take advantage of people if you're kind of in small groups.
100%, yeah.
Up until my year, I think in like 93, 94, they were still putting cartons of camels in the car to give away to the locals and, you know, get by border crossings and stuff like that.
So the title sponsor was really, it came in helpful, yeah.
And of course, that was when, you know, the globe was starting to be pretty anti-smoking.
Yeah.
So I always thought, because RJR Nabisco technically owned Camel at that time. I'm not sure what they, you know, where it is now, but so I always thought they should be like the Nabisco trophy, you know, just get away from Camel, that way the cigarette thing isn't, but what do I know?
Yeah.
Right.
So the vehicles that in like 94, you said it was your
95.
95.
Yep.
So it'd be Discovery 1, 300 TDI.
Yep.
That was a four-door Discovery?
Correct.
Pretty basic on the inside, or did you have air conditioning?
Nope. The only people that had air conditioning are the a couple of the head officials that were on the convoy.
Okay. And then manual transmission, I would
obviously
assume.
Yep.
Yeah. And those vehicles now are incredibly collectible.
Correct.
And incredibly valuable.
Yep.
So like, what made the vehicle special? And if someone's out there, because there's 100 million clones now,
right,
of trophies, like what are some things you can look for to tell an actual trophy truck from a clone?
So, safety devices.
Okay.
Pretty well known in the Land Rover world as far as for safety equipment. They would equip the vehicle with a full internal roll cage.
Okay.
And then your roof rack, because you put lots of weight up top to get all the gear in order to get that four people to where you needed to be. And they actually had extra fuel and water stored up top as well. So that roof rack was literally tied straight through the roof with holes cut in the roof directly to the roll cage.
So would they leak?
Not initially. I mean, I've had mine for years, and it did leak because I took the roof rack off a couple times. So you'd have to reseal it with some new silicone. But yeah. No, for the most part. But they were, you know, that big a hole cut through the roof.
Good size quarters. Hole. Yeah.
Actually, six of them, by the way.
And that's a really good one, Jim, because like I've seen a bunch of trophies, and no one's cutting holes in roofs.
Correct.
Okay.
You'd be lucky if they put an internal cage, and if they do that, they might cut the roof. But most of them I've seen the replicas usually have stuff clamped to the roof rails.
Gotcha.
That's where you probably were too.
So. Right, yeah.
So, roll cage, roof rack, we'll give it away. The springs were special in the rear. They had the two, okay. The double spring
the
and a spring.
Twins, yeah.
Yeah, but they weren't lifted at all.
So stock ride height.
Stock ride height.
Oh, wow.
And actually below stock ride height because of the amount of weight you've got in the vehicle. They had XZLs or XCLs. XZLs, I believe. XZLs, Michelin. They still make a very similar tire. A lot of times you see a bigger version of them, like on Unimogs. They typically will have those kind of tires. Yeah. And I'm a huge fan of Michelin tires. So, and we had two spares. One is on the roof rack, and one is on the spare tire carrier in the back. The way there's besides the internal cage, there's also a dog cage that's put behind the rear seat.
Okay.
That keeps anything in your luggage area from coming onto you in case you had a problem, like
yeah.
You know, if you rolled the vehicle over or anything like that. So there's a couple of special pieces that are very hard to duplicate that you would know to look at a car that's not a real one.
So Jim, you own your actual trophy vehicle.
Correct.
So. That's got to be a pretty wild thing. And like, do you have all the original kit that you had from when you competed?
Most of it. So I was very fortunate. Bill Baker, who was our PR head way back when in the original Land Rover when it came back to the United States.
Sure.
Under Charlie Hughes. So anyways, Bill actually shipped me my vehicle as soon as we came off of Trophy.
Wow.
I had my vehicle for the first... I probably had it for 3 months or so. He forgot to ship me an actual legal plate, so I drove it around for like 2 months with just the Mundo Maya plate, which means nothing in the United States. And numerous times I would be talking to police, and they would never ask.
They wouldn't care.
They thought it was too interesting to look at, and you can't really break the speed limit in it.
Now,
right?
did people know what it was, or was
no,
it a
very,
lot of explaining?
Very okay. Few people knew in the United. And if you're not an off-road guy, certainly back in '95, you would never. Know what Camel Trophy is in the United States. In Europe, it was as well known as the Olympics. Matter of fact, that was one of their nicknames for it. It's called the Olympics of four-wheel drive back
yeah.
then.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
And Bill, maybe I'm like too involved with the Land Rover community now, but it seems like now it's got kind of a legendary status. Like, do you think more people know what it is now than back in the 90s when you brought that thing home?
I would say yes, but it's a select group,
okay.
Right? It's a very focused group.
So when you drive your actual Camel vehicle today, right, do people stop you and ask you about it? Like, does it get a lot of attention?
It does. It got more attention when the names and all the stickers. I've taken about half of the stickers off. It's still got the big Camel Trophy sticker,
yeah.
But the names aren't there. I can't stand driving around with my name on a car. It also had a snorkel tied in with it as well, so I disconnected the snorkel just because I hated hearing all the noise when I opened my window.
Sure.
And unless you're going through water crossings, you don't need it. And I always carried my pieces to make it there if I ever had any problems. But so not a lot of people would know about it, but a lot of people would stop you and ask you, especially that the first few months, they seemed like I got more people stop me because it was looked brand new vehicle still. You know, we had two dents in the vehicle.
Okay.
She got one on a task and I got one on convoy, and small dents. They were in the doors. Those are still there.
You still have them. Yeah, you got to keep those dents.
Now, I only had the vehicle for the first few months, and then it went back to Land Rover, JLR, whatever you want to... Back then, it was Land Rover North America.
Yep.
They took back possession of it, and then they used it... We always used the last year's vehicle and a couple of years before that for training vehicles for the next Camel selection.
Yep.
So it was out of my possession for probably from 96 until probably 06, 07, 08 maybe. I can't remember exactly when I got possession of it again.
Yeah.
And once I did, I've taken
and
care of it.
Now it's yours.
Yeah. Because it was sitting, you know, after they used it for a bunch of years, they kind of let it sit. And you let something sit in New Jersey that has any moisture related to it, and you grow mold. So when I got it back, it needed a pretty thorough cleaning, needed a lot of maintenance. I haven't changed a lot of things on it. I've changed the tires. I've got, you know, KO2s on it. And I put Old Man Emu springs in it.
Cool.
Just to lift it a little bit and carry the weight a little bit better. I don't ever carry the weight that we did then.
So has it been pretty durable throughout the years?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I didn't... So when it was not in my possession, someone got in some deep water and it ended up infiltrating the transmission. Mm. And when I got it back, it had probably... The water had been in the transmission for probably years.
Okay.
So when I changed all the fluids after I first got it, I realized that my transmission was probably not going to be a long-term thing because of all the shavings that came out of it and the molasses that came out of it. I mean, it was thick gear lube with water, you know, makes mayonnaise, right? It lasted about 5 years, believe it or not. It always kind of, it would be very gingerly. You have to always be a little bit interesting with European vehicles, the way they shift and stuff.
Sure.
They're a little more sensitive than American iron, right?
Right.
So the transmission kind of always clicked first to second to third. So I knew that was going to go away. So I guess it's probably been 8 years now. I had Rovers North bring me in a proper, you know, exact transmission.
Oh, cool.
And they gave me a good deal on it. And I put a new clutch and new transmission. And that's about the only, other than springs and maintenance stuff and brakes, obviously, that's the only things I really changed. I mean, I did end up putting 410 gears and ARBs in it, but I still have the original diffs.
Did they have lockers?
No. So old Land Rovers are always... Land Rover's old philosophy was we have such flexible suspension that we can keep tires in contact with the ground a lot more than any other vehicle.
Right.
And if you drive it correctly, you can kind of work your way through that. Now, I'm to me, as hardcore as I've go off-roading,
right,
lockers can be a help as well sometimes.
Yeah, I think so.
I heard you talking about it earlier. So
So when you were competing, this thing was open diff front and back.
Correct. Jeez. Just a center diff lock.
Yeah. And did you guys, like, were there any points in your competition in your truck that you, like, you were really struggling for traction, or any off-road challenges that you really pushed the limits of the truck?
No, I don't remember us ever really lacking traction that a locker would have helped.
Okay.
Because the good thing is that, you know, because it has such supple suspension, unless you're super articulated, both wheels got pretty equal power.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Kind of their, and that was almost their defense. I mean, you know how many years after 95 that our travel team, Land Rover, and a lot of them were Camel Trophy guys, and the UK would send over engineers and be like, what do you want in your next iteration? And we'd be like, lockers, big tires, you know.
All the off-road stuff.
More of everything, yeah. Right? But, you know.
Yeah, it's a different world.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. So.
So what's cool, Jim, is how...
And they
like...
came without sway bars, just to be clear.
Oh, really?
So okay. Not only is it flexible already, but it's a lot like driving around a little bit of a noodle when you're driving on the road, because it really sways, and people get freaked out a little bit because it sways so much around corners.
Now, was that a Camel thing that they removed the sway bars?
Absolutely, yeah. Imagine. Mounts were all still there, but the sway bars were gone.
That would never fly today.
No.
With the lawyers today. So you were driving around, so you've got this very heavy Discovery 1 diesel.
Yeah.
Just wafting.
Pretty top heavy.
Yeah. With the tire on the roof, that's unreal.
But again, the amazing thing about older Land Rovers is all of their weight, even nowadays,
yeah,
the majority of the weight is from your knee down.
Yeah.
That's why we're so good at side tilts and so stable.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. So what do you do with this? Like, is this a museum piece now, Jim?
It's going to end up more museum-y because I got it with about, I want to say 25,000 kilometers on it.
Okay.
It has 102,000 kilometers on it now.
Unreal.
I've taken it on two cross-country trips with my youngest son. 33-day one to begin with, and like a 37-day one after that.
Yeah.
You know, a couple of years apart. So I've used it a lot. I've wheeled it all over the country here.
I think that's so cool.
Yeah, it's been
such a cool story.
It's been a great vehicle. I tend to park it more now than I did just because I don't like to fight rust. So
yeah, you know. I mean, I imagine a lot of them, especially now, are kind of in collections and they're very babied.
Yeah.
So it's amazing that you got 80,000 kilometers. And you know he's a real deal if he's putting locking discs in 410s, right? It wasn't just sticking around the street. That's really cool.
And that was really, the 410s are really, because the bigger tires, you want a little bit more gearing so that it'll pull hills a little bit better.
Right.
Because 354 is the stock gears in most old Land Rovers. And they're fine with stock size tires, but as soon as you get up there, you want to get a little bit extra gearing for yourself. So,
imagine you're definitely among like an elite breed of folks that have actually lived that lifestyle and have done the event. Are you guys still like in contact with each other?
Daphne and I?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
How about you like in the other American Camel participants throughout the years? Do you guys have like, is there like a Facebook group of the...
I am not a social media guy.
Oh, Jim.
I joined Facebook a month ago.
Okay.
Only to sell stuff. And my wife friended me like, cause she put it together for me.
Yeah.
And that totally screwed me up. And now there's like 150 people on the waiting list. And I'm not answering anybody.
So there's no...
I have no friends, okay?
There's no Instagram page of like only Camel guys and gals.
I mean, there might be. I'm not part of it.
You're not in it, though.
No.
But like, are you still in touch with like Tom Collins?
Tom is a dear friend of mine. He doesn't tend to come over and visit me in New England much. But every time I get through Colorado, I try to visit
Tom.
Make sure
you visit him,
And at least hang out a couple of days with him.
That's awesome.
And I see Jim West quite often. So there's a bunch of us, and about half of them worked on the travel team for a long time.
Okay.
But about the other half of them had careers that they didn't want to leave, I guess. So, I had no problem leaving a construction career. I can still do construction anytime I want when I'm not doing this stuff. So.
Right, yeah. What are your big takeaways? Like,
changed my life.
Yeah.
I'm here.
Yeah.
This beats working.
This
with
does
a
be
big
working.
Stick.
Yeah, if you're what we're doing right now is we're in the new Defender Octa, and we're kind of cruising around these beautiful dirt roads on the Colorado-Utah border. So it sounds like it got you into this world that's been like a lifelong passion. Is that right, Jim?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been four-wheeling, but most of it was in New England before then. So since I've been with Land Rover, literally I have gone some of the most amazing places around the globe and off-roaded some of the most amazing vehicles. And as you can tell just from today, usually we're in really places that are really ugly. There's no views. There's no good off-roading.
Yeah.
I'm being sarcastic. There's always good views. I always used to say, one of these times Land Rover's going to do a fun event with some good off-roading. Stay in a really nice place and eat some good food. Did you see that?
No, what was it?
Some big animal just went over that, and it was not a deer. It almost looked like a hog of some sort.
No way.
It was about yay big and about that big around.
Jeez, dude.
So that's my joke, is that one of these times Land Rover's going to do a really nice event someplace. And meanwhile, that's all we do is really nice events.
All you do is
great places.
Come out here with these views. Yeah, it's incredible. Well, Jim, I really appreciate you kind of spending the time and kind of walking me through that adventure. And I think one of the coolest parts is that like the relationships you built are still very much present, right? And then what you've been talking about, if folks watching don't know, is like Land Rover has this long history of doing, even after Camel went away, like G4 and then Trek and these big PR trips to places. And then it sounds like, Jim, that the same people you competed with and against and multiple years have been involved with the brand all these years later.
Absolutely.
Yeah, which is pretty cool. So
one of my favorite trips after Camel Trophy, I've been back to Belize three different trips.
Wow.
Two of them were with Land Rover.
Oh, wow.
And if you've ever seen the picture of the LR3 with water breaking over its hood.
I have seen that picture.
So that picture is from our Belize trip. And it was probably because I didn't have to compete, right? I could just have to take care of journalists and clients and stuff and internals.
Which to me sounds way worse than competing, dealing with journalists, Jim. That's
all a matter of opinion. Tom, it's all a matter of opinion.
Yeah.
So we went down there and did a wonderful press event. It was LR3 media drive, and it rained like for a week before we got there.
Okay.
And we were in the Savannah going through 2 feet of water for miles. And when we got near the bridge we were supposed to cross the river on, when they scouted it a couple months before, it was between 12 and 15 feet water level below the bridge.
Okay.
It was 8 feet above the bridge.
Oh, my God.
We didn't get to the bridge because it was getting too deep, and we turned around when it got well beyond what the wading depth was for LR3s.
Yeah.
But, and that, so that picture is after we turned around and basically didn't go to the first resort we were supposed to go to, we went to the second one a day early. The road was under approximately 3 feet of water. You couldn't see where the road was, so we had some locals with us that where the road turned, they made sure they gave us a spotting. But we were literally in water for miles and miles and miles. Water that most people wouldn't wade through to begin
not
with.
Not just like a river crossing. Like you're,
correct.
You're just going through.
The road
like...
was water. So when we got to that next place, it was... That's probably one of the funnest trips that I've been on.
It's amazing.
Which also, I believe, during one of those waves, we ended up getting... I mean, so the mud was crazy. The mud was like it should have been for our trophy, right?
Yeah.
The mud was crazy. And
they don't get stuck in the water?
They did not. No, because you were basically, most of it, you were on a track. You were just in water,
in water.
Over the track.
Wow.
Was there some recovery? Absolutely.
Yeah,
but
right.
It wasn't anything that I thought we'd... The only couple spots where the road would dip a little bit, and that's where one of those shots were, where they're breaking over the hood. Because that LR3 was only, I think... I want to say 24 or 26 inches wading depth.
26, I think, yeah.
And I should know that, but we change it every so often, so I've lost track.
Every couple of years,
right.
Yeah.
And we were well over 26 inches for way too long of a time. But one of the little legs of that trip, we were in a muddy slog. It was just a muddy track for miles and miles. Lots of winching, lots of recovery, lots of strap snatching. And I had a couple of journalists from New York City.
Okay.
Not exactly intended for outdoor use.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And I go to grab a recovery bag out of the back. And this is like, we're at like 11 o'clock at night. We're supposed to be at dinner by around 7.
Okay.
So we're well.
You're a little behind schedule.
Well behind schedule.
Yeah.
And I open up the back of the Range Rover. Because we had Range Rovers, LR3. And I want to say, no, I don't think there were some Defenders there, but they were obviously, you know, old Defenders.
Yeah.
And they weren't even new then because those were the people that locals that came and helped us on
gotcha.
The route.
Yeah.
So I opened the Range Rover hatch up, and there's a scorpion crawling on the headliner. Now I've got these two citified journalists with me.
Yeah.
And they're like, What's up? I said, I'm just grabbing the recovery bag. I says, but don't freak out. But if you look in the headliner behind the guy that was sitting in the back seat, I says, you're gonna see a scorpion. I don't think I got the whole word out, and I never seen people exit a vehicle as quickly as that.
I bet they got out pretty quick.
Yeah.
What'd you do with the scorpion?
I got him out of the car.
Okay, well that. Yeah.
No big deal. I like bugs and insects and snakes, so I'm
you are in the
I'm
right place for that. Yeah, that's a great story. That honestly, Jim, I would pay an enormous amount of money to time travel to that moment because just personally, not that this matters, but my favorite old time rig is an LR3.
Yeah.
And I've got one as my baby. I've had a couple of them. And like I've always had those dreams of like going through massive water crossings in South America, and you have lived it. You've literally been there. What an amazing thing. Yeah, it's cool. Well, Jim, thank you for this amazing talk. It's been
no problem.
Fun. I appreciate you telling me stories. It's really cool to be able to document this, so I appreciate it.
So really interesting story that we learned about this kind of event. And the cool thing is it's coming back.
Camel Trophy's coming back?
Well, it's not called Camel anymore.
I didn't think cigarettes were in.
Exactly. But the Defender brand is starting a new version of Camel Trophy, which
called
is
called the Zin Trophy.
No, it is not. That's funny, though. That would be really good. No, I believe it's called the Defender Trophy, and it's actually taking place in Africa. Teams from all around the world are going to compete in very similar style competitions using this new Defender that they just showed off. Looks really cool with the steel wheels, similar color montage. So, and it's all supporting kind of animal protection.
Is this replacing the Trek series?
No, this is way above the Trek.
So the Trek will continue.
So you had Camel Trophy at the top, right?
Yep. The new one.
Yep. Land Rover Trek was kind of a watered-down Camel Trophy for dealers.
Okay.
This is then back to what Trek was. So they're going to have trials all around the world for every country to have a team to represent their country.
Can we go covered?
I asked them, so fingers crossed.
What are they saying?
Well, maybe.
Not after listening to this podcast and me
saying to buy a Bronco Wrangler. Yeah, exactly.
If you're listening to this, JLR, never mind.
Okay. Well, folks, let us know what you think in the comments section
below. Hold on. This guy, this yellow, I kind of like the look of him. What's under the hood of this thing?
I don't know.
We don't know.
No, this is still a little bit early on in knowing all the specs, but I would assume probably the four-cylinder or the inline six.
All right, couple other questions that came up during the interview that I was thinking of, all right? First, the Octa and this, rear locker only.
Yeah, but the front, you don't need a front
locker. Oh, like how you...
The four-wheel drive system is so amazing.
All the other vehicles that I brought up, they had...
Yeah, sure.
They were, you know, G's triple locked.
Yeah.
This is rear locker.
But for the capability of what that four-wheel drive system do, I think you'll
be
fine.
So why don't you think they put a front locker? I mean, they certainly
have...
No one
needs a front locker. It's like...
Oh, gosh. You know this, Tommy. People don't buy cars for what they need.
No one knows what a front locker does.
They buy them for what they want.
Okay.
You know, they... You never know, honey. The power could go out. There could be a zombie apocalypse. And then I've got that G with those three buttons right there in the middle. I mean, there's a reason that the G puts them right there, center. The most bold thing you see, right? Even though most people will never touch them, they're there because that's what that vehicle represents. It's the DNA of that vehicle. So why not a triple locker on this?
Well, folks, debate it in the comment section below.
I think these are good points.
Sure, the fine points.
You're just trying to go on that program, aren't you? You're trying to get your...
No, I'm trying to go to a meeting about our 401ks, which started a minute ago.
Okay.
So
there we go, guys.
We got to cut this short. I'm sorry.
We cut this for a boring 401k meeting. Sorry. Thank you for joining us. And as always, where should they go, Tommy, to watch your video of the Octa?
AllTFL.com.
We'll see you next time. Ciao.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.